A huge shout out of thanks to our major sponsor, Pertec. If you have Pertec on your team, they will never let you down. Visit Pertec at pertec.com.au. And for all your travel needs, make sure you visit our great friends at Tripadeal, tripadeal.com.au. Excited to bring James Dack today because, James, you have such an interesting story. I just want to thank you for your time. We've got you straight out of the Woolloomooloo PCY, so you've come straight from training. You haven't even, you're still sweaty, you're in your PCYC shirt, so that is definitely going to be a topic of mine because you do so much for them. And I know it means a lot to you, so we want to go there. But I just want to explain, my podcast, mate, is about... There's a lot of teachers, coaches, business leaders, athletes, trainers, parents. Yeah. There's a lot of people that listen where I always ask myself in the back of my mind when we chat is, how is this helping someone else? So in all your answers, I know you do anyway because I know you and what you do away from here. I know how much you inspire other people, but just have that in the back of your mind. Every time I ask a question, I am thinking about who's listening. So the PCYC stuff we have to start with because you give so much to them. Could we go there? Why it is? I mean, there's so much passion that comes out of you when we talk PCYC. It's so genuine to the point you've actually just sat here and you're still wearing it with pride. What is it about the PCYC? Can we go there to start with?
Oh, absolutely. It's an easy one to talk about. I suppose, you know, thinking about, you know, you coming here today, I sort of thought about what it was that you might want to talk about. You know, this was one topic I suspected. So when I was 8 years old, three things happened. I met a friend of mine, Alan Ferguson, that I talked to you about in the garage. We'll possibly talk about him later. He was one of my best mates, a beautiful, beautiful guy, great athlete. Second thing was someone gave me a Roosters t-shirt when I was eight, and I'll never forget it. It was a screen printed red t-shirt, Eastern Suburbs District Junior Rugby League Football Club underneath, and a big rooster on the front, and it had its sort of chest out and its wings sort of out. And I thought when I put that on, I felt like I was like 10 foot tall and bulletproof, and I wanted to be like that rooster with its chest out. And so that was sort of when I started following the Roosters. And the third thing was I walked through the doors of the Woolloomooloo PCYC. Now, a lot of kids, and you know, I've got to be careful when I want to talk about this because I my family situation wasn't the worst, situation in the group of kids I grew up with. When you're in Department of Housing, Housing Commission, homes which we're very grateful to have been given one when our family, a single parent, mother, two bedroom terrace, three kids in one room and your mother in the other. It was something that we really appreciated, and being in that area of Woolloomooloo was the greatest. I even talked to mates about it now, how much fun and how much pleasure we got out of growing up together in that area, because there were places like the PCYC. And when you went there, you know, you sort of jump up and down on a trampoline, you know, you're drinking red cordial, you're laughing your lungs out, and you're to the point where you're almost sort of, you know, dying of suffocation. You're laughing and jumping around that much, and the activity. But the thing for me, Hayden, was, it was respite from, situations at home that you might not want to be involved in. And that was similar for a number of us that went there. And then in that also, you had some really lovely people that that donated their time. And I'm talking about police and some of the volunteer staff there that were mentors. And for me, that was just, it was such a pleasurable experience as a kid. That I wanted to somehow repay the favour at some point in my life for all the help that it gave me as a kid.
Yes.
So that's the essence of it, mate.
So what's your position now with the PCYC?
Well, I've always been involved with the Woolloomooloo Club. You know, it was the first sort of club established in 1937. It used to be an old sandstone police station, which is, yeah. You know, now not that. But I've always been on the committee of the Woolloomooloo Club, and I was president there for a decade. Then I went back and had another stint as president.
Yeah.
But I'm still on the committee there. But I was asked several years ago to go on the board of directors of the PCYC New South Wales, which I've been on for, I think, 8 years now off the top of my head.
Okay.
Might be a bit longer, but what we've done through, not just me, mate, there's been some magnificent people, incredibly well led by Nicole Silbara from Macquarie Bank. She's the chairperson. She's like phenomenal. CEO just left, Dom Teagle, who has been fabulous. And a whole host of other people that are really smart at what they do. And subsequently, that's transcending into the growth of the organisation.
How big is it now?
It's 71 clubs.
71 clubs, yeah, you sit across. And
yeah. You
still tell the listeners, I think we may have first met. I might have been with Brad Fittler in possibly a City Origin team or definitely a New South Wales Origin team. We always use a facility and we're in there punching away, and then there's Dacky in the corner on the punching bag. And
yeah.
And I know Freddie has so much respect for you. You have a history with him that was quite clear, and you're both very similar in how much you give. You're givers, you know, always doing stuff for other people. Mm. But yeah, that's where we first met. So to the listeners, you're still in there every day. Is that right? You're still in there training.
I try to, mate. I think that the push and shove of life, I find that is... As I said to a mate of mine the other week, it's cheaper than the therapist.
Yeah.
You go in there and you sort of decompress.
Yeah.
You know, I go in there just, you know, the mental gymnastics of, you know, did a cross training session with a guy from Soul Train up top, and
yeah.
I might do some boxing with Drisco and a couple of other friends.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just that mental health aspect, apart from the fitness aspect, that just counterbalances all the push and shove of life.
Well, and it obviously gives you great memories every time you walk in there.
Oh, childhood memories. I love it, Hayden. I love it. I mean, it's just so many people that I met, wonderful people, so many pictures, so much memorabilia. I get a real kick when I walk into it, and not so much when I walk out. I'm sweating and sort of exhausted, but, you know, grab a cup of coffee and try and reboot. But it's just there's a lot of intangible emotional joy that comes from the walls of that that particular club and the whole organisation, mate. It's just, we built a club at Wagga recently. It's phenomenal for those, you know, listening to the podcast. If you look online, it's a brand new club that in that community. It's just such a joy for me to see a facility like that delivered to a community like Wagga, and we've got a number of others on foot at the moment. We're building another one in Parramatta at the moment, or not at the moment, but it's on the drawing board, and it will come into fruition. One in Dubbo, and places where the police have given us a sort of strategic heat map, if you like, about where they're needed.
Yeah,
and then we deliver it. Try to deliver them for those communities.
Well, I can't think of a perfect member to have on the board who actually lived. I mean, you mentioned the word respite there for kids.
Yeah.
So there's obviously. I mean, usually I'd go with a guest. I'd get to know and hear a bit about their life. But you almost basically said it there. There was reasons why. There's obviously some tough upbringings going on for kids that you grew up with that went there for the respite. But then you talk about it with such fond memories too, like how much fun that place is for a kid, the mentors that are in there. I guess for a couple of hours a day for those kids, that's their happy place.
Yeah.
That's probably leads me to, like, there's so much passion you have for that place when I've met you in there. last time I was in there with Steve Driscoll, and he always helps us out with the Origin team. I love Steve. Stevie, if you're listening, we need you on the show. You are going to be a fascinating guest.
Phenomenal, yeah. Driscoll. I don't know how.
So he tells me, last time I was in there, he says, you know about Dacky in this place? And I said, oh, kind of. Like, Freddie's told me a little bit. He goes, you know he lived in that room there?
Yeah.
For a while?
Yeah. With my brother.
Could you share that with the listeners? You actually, for a long time, lived in what is now the change rooms of... When we all went in there, we did our session, we go in, have a shower, and then we went out, and usually with Freddie, we'll go and feed the homeless or do something. That's a day for us in camp where we bond through hard work, but we also do some good things for other people. That means a lot to him, and I think you were a big part of that when we all started this, but... But Driscoll was telling me, see this area where you're getting changed. Dacky lived there.
Mm.
Tell me about that.
Mm. It's a funny one, Hayden. Like, and just on the topic of Freddie, he's one of the nicest and most talented guys I've met in all sorts of different ways, and a wonderful family man as well. I have great admiration and respect and love for that guy. And I was actually hurt by the recent sort of pile on the media and all that sort of stuff, but that's for another time. But
yes.
So it got to a point where my mother passed away and my sister moved down, and we've got this 3-bedroom terrace in Woolloomooloo. And I said to my brother, I said, look, this, we've actually got to get out of here. And he looked at me and said, you know, where do we go? And I said, I'm not sure. I said, but us two here in a 3-bedroom house, there's some needy families out there, and, you know, we should, you know, and there were a couple of reasons behind it. That was predominantly the first one, because, you know, there were some needy families. I knew that. We were very, very needy when we first went in, but not so much at that time. And I said, mate, we've just got to cut it and jump off the cliff and then just see what happens, you know. So I went to the Department of Housing in place and I said, look, we're going to quit the house. And the guy said, are you sure? You know, there's a waiting list. I said, mate, yeah. I said, there's more needy people than us, and my brother was a bit nervous. And to be honest with you, I was like quivering inside about the actual leaving. And, you know, I thought to myself, you know, we can't stay here in this house. A, but B, I wanted to break the cycle of being dependent.
How old were you?
Early 20s.
Right. And the brother, how old was your brother?
He would have been 18.
Okay.
Mm.
So you're basically looking after the family. Is
well,
that
you know, when my mother passed away, my brother and sister were still at school. So that's, you know, when I had to get a job at St. Vincent's Hospital, we touched on earlier.
Yeah, but, we'll definitely go
there. So talking to the manager at the PCYC, strangely, the building was, you know, after hours being broken into and people were using it. You know, they're not just training and doing sort of stuff with just local people jumping through the window and stuff. And he said, look, you know, some of the stuff's getting damaged. And I said, look, you know, we're about to quit our house at Woolloomooloo. He said, you know, he was shocked. He said, mate, are you sure? And I told him why. And he said, look, why don't you come and stay here for a bit and, you know, you and your brother and sort of look after the club? Because, mate, what we will save in damages with you two being here as sort of pseudo, you know, security types, will offset, you know, what it might cost us, you know, in potential rent. And I said, oh, mate, wow, that's great. So that area used to be a storeroom where we lived, and I got a mate of mine to come in and put some carpet down, and then we got a bar fridge and a toaster and a little TV and a bed and a couch and this and that, and stuck it in there. And it was, I'll tell you, Hayden, it was like heaven on earth with my brother and I. We get up and play racquetball at 4:30 in the morning and, like, had breakfast and then subsequently, you know, go to work all ready to go, you know. And, you know, it was a really special time for me. It was really enjoyable. And that's the essence of it, mate. We were there for probably just over a year and a bit. They wanted us to stay on, but I thought, no, can't keep doing
this. So you go in there now after a workout, you go in the showers, and that's where you used to sleep, just over there by the locker room.
Absolutely.
Wow.
It was a special time, mate. It really was. And, you know, as we were talking before about people with money, without money and all that sort of stuff, and I know a lot of people with a lot of money, and I know a lot of people without it, but, you know, essentially people are either good, bad, or indifferent, regardless of how wealthy or otherwise they are. And that's how, and I know you do, I've seen you, I've heard a lot about you, mate, and that's why I'm sitting here, to be honest with you. And that's how I judge people. You know, what's under the bonnet, who you are, how you deliver yourself, how you look after the people around you, you know, your family, all that sort of stuff. That's essentially it for me. So, yeah, it taught me a lot, mate. It taught me a lot. As I say, it was just, those were like golden years of my life. And on the odd occasion, I've said, the best years of my life are when I grow up. Well, you know, what about, you know, us being married? And I said, well, no, I mean, as a kid. Talking about as a kid, of course.
You just reminded me. I once rang my wife after the World Cup final of the 2008. I was working with the Kiwi team against Australia, and which was a strange feeling. But there was Wayne Bennett, an Aussie. There was myself, an Aussie. And anyway, you know what it's like when you've worked with someone a long time. There was Nathan Kalis was the captain, and I'd been through a lot with him. His brother Jason played for the Roosters. Okay. Yeah, so Nathan was the captain of the Kiwis, but also the Eels, and we'd worked together such a long time. I know I've gone off your story here. I made the mistake of, because we'd been through so much, and I knew he'd been through so much, and even that camp, he'd been through so much. When he won that trophy, like, and it was history, like no one had, New Zealand have never won it.
Phenomenal.
But because I'd know the sacrifices he'd been through and I'd shared a lot, this like joy just came over me, and I'm on the phone and I said to my wife, that's the best moment of my life.
Wrong.
Meanwhile, we'd only a month before the camp just had our third child, which again, she's such a champion mum. I'd even left her at home with three kids under three and I'm off enjoying the world and the World Cup and whatever. Like, she's a champion. And so you imagine her on the end of the phone going,
not happy.
Hang on. I said, no. I mean, like, my working life,
Rookie mistake, mate.
We got married without kids.
Yeah.
But sorry, I just digress because you gave me I mean, you've had all sorts of sports. You've had the Silk Tails. You've had New South Wales Origin, City Origins. You've had AFL. Like, so many people have come through there. It's a great place to go, a great facility. But in the photos, I love looking around old boxing gyms and their photos on the wall. But I've seen one of yourself, Drisco, and Toby Green from the Giants, the AFL. Now, he's a legend of that club. He's the best. He's one of I haven't had any AFL people on the show, but Toby Green, if you're watching, you're welcome anytime. I might call you to get him on. But what's the relationship with him? Because that clearly popped out at me, that photo.
Well, you know, a friend of mine is the deputy chairman of the Giants. He actually wasn't at the time. I think he was on the board, and he's through his efforts and energy, Adrian Fonseca got elevated to the deputy chairman role. Should be chairman soon, you know, I'd hope, with I think Tony Shepherd, who's a phenomenon in himself and a legend, is about to step down, and then that chairman's role becomes vacant. But you've got, I met, you know, through Adrian and his wife Nancy, were introduced to the club back in 2016, I offered.
Won that grand final.
Oh yeah.
We don't go there. It looks painful to talk about. Sorry, mate.
Exactly. So what happened was, I offered to the Giants people were so generous to myself and my wife Mary that inviting us out to games and coming out to the box, this, that, and the other. I thought, well, I'm going to actually add some value myself, and they sort of weren't sure about it until post the event when. They actually, I did a training session for them. I was channeling Hayden Knowles. We did a CrossFit to warm up, sort of cross training for half an hour up at the top level of the club. And then we came down and we split them up and did some boxing and wrestling. And then we got them all into the boxing room. We had a thing called the Ring of Fire, where I stood around, and this mate of mine, I'm sure you've done this, calls out two people he thinks that should probably punch on, and they just punch on, and he'll call it when he thinks it's enough. You know, and they might not think it's enough, but he'll think it's, you know, that's enough. But There's a photo of all of us standing around in a circle, and Toby, oh God, he would have been, God, he must have been like 19 or 18 or something or other, and you could tell there was a handful of them, you know, Steve Canelio and Shane Mumford and all those guys. It was just a phenomenal sort of group of talented young guys that were, and anyway, they called this training session, they actually had a fly on the wall camera. I didn't realise at the time, but they videoed the whole session and they've still got it on their website, and they called it Out of the Comfort Zone. And in that, I got to know some of these players, Lockie Whitfield and you know, all these guys like Harry Himmelberg and so forth, these phenomenal athletes and great people, mate. And you know, I seem to have this, connection, if you like, with Toby. And we kept sort of catching up every now and then. And then we started sort of doing some boxing with each other. And, I just felt like, look, at the time, you know, a couple of years ago, I thought he was one of the most misunderstood people I've ever met, you know, because my view of him is quite a shy sort of a bloke and a sort of a, you know, I'll lead from my actions and that's how I'm going to do it, you know. Other than that, sort of, that's sort of where he saw it. But what happens is people like him, because they're such natural leaders, everyone sort of gravitates to the conclusion that this guy should be the captain of the club. And he's done it so brilliantly, mate. You know, we'd catch up every now and then. And, you know, that photo you saw with me, him and Drisco, and there was one with Harry Himmelberg. There'd been a half a dozen of those. And, you know, in introducing him to Drisco and a handful of other friends and so forth, you actually get tidbits from everybody. And I think that from his own observations that, you know, that everybody wanted him to be the captain of the club, and then it came to the conclusion himself. He just realised, you know, I have to be this. You could almost see that, the cogs turning in his head.
Yes.
You would talk about, you in training, you sort of have a coffee afterwards and you'd see the cogs turning in his head about, you know, how am I going to do this? And then it was all him, you know, he was just a great athlete, great bloke, misunderstood for a while. And now I think the real Toby Green has been conveyed to the media. And then he's just the person he always was, mate. From my perspective, he's the person he always was.
Well, that's an interesting point, because there's a bit of a myth that all leaders have to be so perfect in all these ways and they're loud and what, but he was very shy and very quiet, but he led through actions.
Yeah.
He was the hardest worker. So he had traits of a real leader, but then in the current world in high profile sport, he had to learn some other things, obviously.
Mm.
And everyone, for me, leadership is everyone's on a journey. Like, you're a great leader of people on a different stage of your journey than what he is, you know. But he everyone's on a different journey. But he was a leader that I'd love to get him on the show, because that is a topic that a lot of my listeners are into learning.
Well, you guys got a lot in common.
And
I think he'd love to meet you because of your background. I mean, I've been at that dinner. We went out to dinner with some different people, and you know, and one of them was Sterling Mortlock, captain Australian Wallabies. Another guy was Jeff Dixon, who used to run Qantas. And you know, we've been out to dinner, and he could see him like just
learning.
And he's a really smart cookie. I mean, you know, as I say, he's got a lot under the bonnet, that guy. And people are just starting to realise who he is now.
So some of those times of your life, you mentioned where your mother passed away and you're basically looking after a younger brother, younger sister. So you went to work.
Yeah.
Sorry, we might as well go back to schooling. So dad's not around. So mum looked after you and put you through private school,
don't
right?
know how she did it, mate. You know, yeah. It was I think to the point where, you know, she worked as a cleaner at Stock Exchange late at night and come home sort of early in the morning. And she, you know, the funny thing about her, mate, that I noticed, I'm just in awe of her as a person, how strong she was, how proud she was, always had us well-dressed, well-fed, private schools. My head spins when I think about it, to be honest with you.
How did she do
this? I don't know, mate. I don't know. So She never had a boyfriend after my father left. Never had a man in the house or any of that sort of stuff. And I'm just like, I'm like, she dedicated her whole life to us to the point where I believe that she became ill and unfortunately passed away with cancer because she was so like stressed and dedicated to us that, and it was a hard road, mate. Like three kids and private schools and, you know, on your own and
working numerous jobs to fund this.
Yeah, didn't have any support.
Yeah.
From you know, my brother and I used to sort of say, your father, like, it's not my father, it's your father, you know, as a joke amongst ourselves. Hardly any support from him, if almost negative support.
Yeah.
And I don't know how she did it, mate, but she got ill. Unfortunately, she passed away when I was 20 and my brother and sister were still at school, which sort of led into me having to get a job, which I did do, as a porter at St. Vincent's Hospital, which was... Yes.
And there's a great story that we probably should share because there's a little nugget of gold there. You had a decision to make, but could you tell me what the porter did and when you bumped into the CEO? It's a bit of a life-changing moment when you think about it, that moment when you bumped into the CEO. I've heard the story from Steve Driscoll, who told me before I came here, but I need to hear it from you. You were working as a porter at St. Vincent's Hospital.
Yeah, you know, look, it was one of those sort of jobs where, you know, the paycheck job, you know, each fortnight you get paid and you think, oh, thank God I got paid for this. You know, it was sort of, pardon me, it was, I call it a dead-end job, you know, needed to pay the bills, got the job, you know, so on. So I'm sort of dragging myself around the place and, you know, I dropped a patient off to what used to be called the Cameron Wing where they did all the heart transplants, dropped the patient off up there on a bed, and there was a ramp between the main hospital and the Cameron Wing, and as I'm coming back, I've jumped on the back of the bed with bumpers on it, and I'm riding the bed down this ramp going, I thought 100 kilometres an hour, probably a bit less, and I'm bumping into the walls and all this stuff, and in the peripheral vision, I've seen someone at the end of the corridor. And I've jumped off the back of the bed and pulled the thing up just, you know, without a meter away from him, you know. And this guy looks at me in a stern sort of fashion and he said, who are you? And because I'm like 17, 18, got a chip on my shoulder the size of the Harbour Bridge, I'm, who are you? And he sort of says, I'm the CEO of the hospital. I'm John Ireland. And I said, oh, hi, I'm James Dack. And he said, I want to see you in my office tomorrow morning, you know, bright and early, you know. And I thought, oh. So my mother was in hospital at the time, I'll never forget it, and I'm lying in bed and I'm rolling around, I'm thinking, oh, I don't need to go and see that guy, you know, who's he think he is? And, you know, I'm sort of an angry kid, mum's in hospital, kids are at school, I've got a dead-end job. And I'm lying there and I sort of had this moment where, you know, and I call them moments of truth, and I've had several of them. I know you've had several of them, you know, that fight you had that you might have passed.
The listeners have never heard about that.
You've got to talk about that. That's a great story. So, you know, I'm in bed, as I say, moment of truth. I'm deciding whether I'm actually going to go into his office and confront him. And then my mother, I thought, what would my mother want me to do? And she said, you've got to be a man in every situation. Even though I'm sort of 17 years old at this time, I thought, you know what? I'm going to follow her advice. And I'm just talking to myself in my head. It's just all head noise. Yeah. But I know she'd want me to do that. So I got dressed, you know, I'm going to be a man. I go in his office, bang on the time. I sit there and we spoke for 3 hours. Now, John Ireland, who's Daniel Anderson's father-in-law, is one of the most compassionate and passionate and empathetic and kind people I've ever met. And I'm still in contact with him. We've been out to lunch. The human resources manager at St. Vincent's Hospital, Ian Thorley, is a friend of John's. The three of us go out to lunch. We went out probably the last time 3 or 4 months ago. So when I was 17, you know, met him and we're still friends. Now, I, in my life, I mean, John's not a wealthy guy. He's got a great family and he's a very loving and caring human being for everybody. And I wanted to be like him, you know. So after we met 3 hours, sorry, that was my phone. After we met for 3 hours, he actually, strangely, promoted me. gave me a promotion. She said, you're an intelligent kid. He said, you've got a bit of go in you. You're, you know, optimistic and all that sort of stuff. I said, yeah, thanks. So next thing you know, I'm working in a clerical position, and then I got promoted into the pay office as a clerk in the pay office. And strangely, to fast track the story, 5 years later, I'm the payroll manager. So I'm responsible for 2,500 people at St. Vincent's Hospital. I've got 4 or 5 people working for me. And 5 or 6 years down the track, I was poached by the Department of Health in the Industrial Relations Division. And how that happened was a group of all the payroll managers come together and discuss their issues. And then these people thought, well, this guy's, you know, a bit different, you know, in a good way. And invited me in to talk with them, and basically created a position for me that ran all New South Wales public hospital payroll. So, pardon me, I had, again, half a dozen people working for me, and all the people from the payroll, all the payroll managers of all the hospitals in New South Wales reported to, well, not reported to me, but would ring me about queries and how to manage things and all that sort of stuff. So, national wage increases, I was responsible for all that sort of stuff, award increases, and there were varying awards from cleaners through the specialists.
They deserve so much more, don't they? All those people that you were paying in that medical system.
Oh, incredible, mate.
Like what they're doing. And I said this only recently to my wife, some of the positions out there, I think there were some strikes going on. I saw something on the side of an ambulance or something. These people deserve so much more. Like, I'm working in elite sport, and to think about the money that we earn in elite sport compared to what someone's earning saving lives, and like the police force, for example, like what they're doing. And I've seen it firsthand. Like, my wife worked in that space for a long time, and you see the type of shifts they do, the type of stuff they have to handle, the type of damage that can do to them. They deserve so much more money, and you were the one fighting to get them all pay increases. And
Oh, not so much me doing that, mate. I was basically affecting the increase for them, you know, through the payroll system from a mechanical point of view. Not so much that, but you know, everything you've said, I agree with completely. You know, they're just like phenomenal human beings. I don't know if I could do it, to be honest. You know, people come in to, you know, the emergency centre at St Vincent's, you know, the casualty ward, you know, from having an accident or whatever the case may be, and these people are in pieces, and they're just cool as a cucumber, trying to put them all back together. I don't know if I can manage that.
Well, mate, you know what? There's a great friend of mine, Craig Catterick, who you see him in the Origins or the Test matches, in the orange shirt, the medical guy on the field, you know.
Yeah, no, he's a great bloke. I've heard a lot about him. Yeah. I actually met him for the first time up in Adelaide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great bloke. Yeah. So I'm digressing, but some stories of being on the field with him, where my role on field, if you ever see me in that role, is I'm basically just delivering coaches' messages. I'm not medical at all. All I'm doing is, so if Freddie radios through, I say exactly what he says. Yep. If he says, go and tell the halfback this, that's my on-field role. The most valuable person on the field at that moment in an off, besides a player, that medical guy that players can feel safe with. Craig has a background in emergency nursing. He has a background as a police officer. Yep. He has all sorts of, he's got a fair background. But on field, I've been on the field where a player he's unconscious, he's broken his neck, and I'm out there, basically I have to assist, right? But to see Craig so calm at that moment, and to be able to communicate with the doctor, with the trainer, with the other guy, you do this, hey, and then, there was another time there's a player's legs facing the other way, and like I can't even look at it, but
crazy.
He's like very calm, makes the player feel okay, feels safe, hey, everything will be okay, and you do this. Those people are so special. In fact, I should make an effort on the podcast to go and talk to a person in that space because they have amazing skills.
Yeah, it's funny how people have that cool, under pressure sort of nerve. I actually met lucky to have met the guy who was the cave diver for that soccer team that got caught
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, and I asked him that question and he said, you know, I don't even think about it. I said to him, you know, have you ever in that situation, you know, you had to go in a couple of times and bring the kids out? What they did, they dove into the cave, obviously. And I think one, I know for sure, but maybe two of the two divers were killed trying to do it, local divers. And these guys were specialists, you know, cave divers that you know, the Australian guys that got them out, but they had to anaesthetise them more or less, and then through these narrow channels in pitch black, just like. And I said to him, mate, was there a moment where you actually second guessed yourself, where you panicked, where you? And he said, no. He said, there's no time for that. He said, once you start going down that path, it's wow. You know, but then like Craig, I had the great fortune to have met him in Adelaide, and I'd heard a lot about him anyway, along the lines of what you said. It was just, it was great to meet him.
Yeah, he's a great fella. So back to that story. So that was a bit of a life-changing moment. You said to me that you were thinking about not turning up for that meeting.
Yeah.
CEO said, I'll see you at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
You were almost going to say, nah, that's it. Like sleepless night the night before. Not keen on, but you just fronted up to it, and what a life-changing moment, because
it was
your career then. I mean, very, very successful in many ways since, but do you look back at that moment as changing moment?
I do.
Does John know this? Have you expressed that to him?
He does.
Yeah,
he does.
Right.
He does. I mean, I when I recently got that King's birthday honor, I rang him straight away as soon as I got an email, and I said, mate, this is you. This is sort of, you know, in my mind, you know, a payback reward for your effort and energy that you put into me when I was 17. This is sort of the culmination of all those, you know, wonderful things you've done in your life, you know, resulted in, and I'm sure there are several other people that have rung him to thank him for his kindness. As well, I'm sure it's not just me, but for me, it was. I rang him and I said, "Mate, thank you." And this is what's happened, and may never have happened if you hadn't spent that time with me that day in the corridor, and subsequently we met the next morning. You know, everything. You know, it's like sliding doors. You know, moments of truth are key, mate, because that moment for me, as you pointed out just then, was pivotal in terms of where I'm sitting right now in front of you. If I didn't turn up, I don't know what would have happened, mate. But I don't know. I just found my mother, her strength and energy channeled through me. I channeled that, you know, into me, and I subsequently turned up. So I was just lucky. I don't know if it's lucky, but it set a platform of, you know, fronting up to everything and anything that might be palatable or unpalatable or challenging.
Yeah.
No matter what it is, and I prepared myself for it, you know, with that, in that moment, being 17 and being, you know, in that headspace and all the rest of it with my kid, with his brother and sister at school and my mother in hospital, etc. And as I said to you before, mate, I don't want any sympathy or empathy from anybody. I've had a great life. I've had a wonderful upbringing, wonderful kid, great mother, not so great father, but, you know, there were other people in that area that were less fortunate than our family. You know, you know, I had my mother till I was 20 and she was a phenomenon. Some people didn't have that, you know, even have that.
Yeah, so you have, there's some, I love talking to you, mate, because you're always, there's some challenges you went through and we don't even have time to go through all of them, but you always spin it back to being very optimistic of opportunities and very grateful of, you're always very grateful, and then you're always thinking of other people doing it harder. Like there's other people that wouldn't, there's a way you think. I don't know what was the influence. That's all your mum's influence.
Yeah I think so, mate. I've just noticed in my life from people that I respect and have spent time with that optimism, you know, it turns into sort of opportunity, you know, and that no one wants to spend time with someone that's sort of dragging their heels and sort of complaining and carrying on, you know, and I've sort of never been like that, I suppose. Maybe a couple of close mates might tell you different, but, I just think that permeates into, having a nice life, mate. Yeah. Successful people around you. You want to bring that to the table. And I don't know. As I say, I think it came from my mother. She was a proud woman, hardworking woman, honest woman, and all of those sort of things. Helped me be the person I am.
So after that career, what made the career change? Was it after that in the medical system, you then went real estate?
Yeah.
Yep.
So, like a lot of things in life, mate, I know you love a challenge, and sort of so do I. So then I was playing touch football with a mate who was in real estate, and he said to me, "You'd be great at real estate." And I said, "Sure, And then we talked more about it, and it got more serious, and it got to a point where I was helping. He'd left the company that he was involved with, and yeah. I was helping him in his company that he'd just started in real estate. And it wasn't doing all that well, to be honest with you. But then a couple of things happened. It was this complete timing dynamic shift. And this guy, unfortunately, his father passed away. And on the back end of that, there was an estate and he was left an amount of money. And at the same time, the previous company that he'd worked for, the principal of that company had contracted AIDS, and he was it was a boutique firm in Paddington, and so he wanted to sell his company.
Yeah.
Then his father passed away, left him the money to be able to buy the company. So it came together like that, and then I'm one of those guys that you just jump off the cliff when you need to, know what I mean, and you hope you fly. And I thought, I'm looking around and I quite like the idea of the real estate. It gives you freedom. It's sort of the last bastion of the entrepreneur. The harder you work, supposedly, the more you make and all that type. I like that from a work ethic perspective. So I became the founding partner in that business. It was a wild ride, Hayden, mate. I was working 7 days a week, and as I say to a lot of guys in sport and stuff, like the Flegg guys, the Roosters guy, I hope they win the comp. They're a great bunch of kids. It's nosebleed commitment, mate. Nosebleed commitment, which is what I had to have for this real estate thing, because it was all encompassing, mate. It's like, every time you went into someone's house, it's a job interview, and you either came out with it or you didn't. And then you had to, if you didn't, then you had to in my mind, I've got almost like a videotape of what I did wrong, so that I'd correct it. And the next time I'd be better. And the next time I'd be better, to the point where I just drove myself crazy wanting to be the best I could be. So ended up, for the 20 years that we were in the company, I was the number one salesperson. I was sales manager for a bit too.
You won all awards. I did a little bit of research. You a huge, most successful real estate in Sydney. So, but you've, in and amongst that, without even needing to talk how big that got and money, you obviously did very well out of it. We don't even need to go there. You just delivered some gold to anyone in any sport or any business. You said it's something that we're big on. You must have talked to Freddie 1,000 times, because there's something Freddie and I are both big on with any teams we work in. It's first impressions. And you just said it in a way where every time you walked into a house, it was like a job interview. You had a first impression to give. And then not only that, you then reviewed it and analysed it and how to get better. If you're a young athlete right now and you're a young, let's say you mentioned Roosters, so let's talk rugby league. There's a lot of listeners, rugby league. Every kid, every time he turns up to training, in particular, if he gets invited into a camp or under 17s or 9, it doesn't matter, emerging origin camp, it doesn't matter. You have a first impression that you give off through how you look, how you present, your first action, the energy you give, how well you communicate. and everything is then being reviewed and analysed, and the best ones are doing their own review and analysis and how can I get better. But whether you like it or not, there's coaches and people analysing you all the time.
Yeah.
And you just said it in a way where, I've had Cameron Murray on this show before, where only on the audible version, but there's a great story of where we had him in an emerging camp once, and the first impression we ever had gave us reason to trust him. The first impression, how he trained, how he ran to the drill, how much energy he gave, how much attention to detail he put into the drills. He was a young kid at the time. You could see his character.
Mm.
Then we brought him into the PCYC and we put him in the boxing ring. And we brought in a world-ranked boxer at the time. He was number four in the world, Bilal Akaway. We brought him in. You were there, I think, watching this night. But we actually went to Bilal and I said to him, mate, could you put some pressure on this young kid? We want to see how he goes under pressure.
Mm.
So Bilal went to town on body shots only.
Yeah.
And Cameron Murray would not take a backward step. He was just fronting up the whole time. Mm. And he would not stop either until I walked over and tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, that's enough. He wouldn't stop.
Mm.
So the whole time the head coach is watching and he's giving Freddie reason to trust him. Like that was evidence. Mm. I can trust this kid. Mm. He'll never stop. He'll never give up. How we saw him in emerging camp only 2 or 3 years earlier. There's all these reasons why you trust this bloke.
Mm.
But he gave so many first impressions that then there was this moment in Origin in a game where Tedesco scores in the corner, one of the most famous memories ever we have in Origin. It was 30 seconds to go, it was 20 all at the time, and Tedesco scores.
I think Freddie ran onto the field.
Freddie ran on the field. I had to tell him, get off, because I was worried they were going to take the try away.
I love that bloke.
But the story that I'm getting at that relates to your work in the real estate was, there was about 10 minutes before that where Cameron Murray was so fatigued that I'm running off the field going, hey, Freddie, you might want to look at an interchange. I'll keep going. Yeah. I'll keep him going. I'll go and talk to him, but keep an eye on him. And did that a couple of times. Freddie goes, no, I trust him. I trust him.
Wow.
So we made another interchange and we left him out there. But the word trust came because of all the reasons, the first impression that we had of him so long ago, we now trust him for this moment. I don't know if you remember, Boyd Cordner, one of the best leaders of all time, plays the ball, a tough carry. He always put his hand up, give me that carry.
Freak.
The next play, Cameron Murray, under so much fatigue, the attention to detail in his catch, listening and communicating with Mitchell Pearce, called the play. The ability to catch it and pass it under that level of fatigue, because remember I told you for 10 minutes before he was on his knees.
Yeah.
He made that pass that everyone remembers, the Tedesco try, Blake Ferguson running down the sideline. Not many people remember the Cam Murray moment, but I do because there's such a backstory. Such a backstory of the reason why he was trusted was there was a first impression, and it was an emerging camp of young kids.
Yep.
It was a first impression he gave. So all these kids every day, we always say that, you can give a first impression with your every day, with how your first action, as soon as you cross the training line, your first action is a first impression to your teammates. Yeah. And that builds trust in each other. But you just said it in a way that I think relates to every industry. I've gone off on a tangent there talking rugby league, but you've said it in a way where first impression in any industry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you ended up so successful. We don't need to.
Yeah, thanks,
people
mate.
Can people
yeah.
can Google that if they want.
Work that out. But you know, it's funny. Like there's a couple of stories there that you know. I love league. You know, that taught me a lot of lessons as a kid.
Yeah.
But you know, talk about Brad Fittler. I don't remember if you remember the time, and I can't remember whether it was the second series that we won when we got beaten in the first game, and we went to Perth. Do you remember
yes.
that?
Yes.
And he made all those changes.
Seven changes.
So I had a mate of mine out of Perth who'd been diagnosed. It was terminally ill, unfortunately, and a great bloke. And Brad had met him before. He rang me from Perth. He said, oh, Dackie, is there any chance you can get me a couple of tickets to Origin? And blah, 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 blah. And I said, oh, gee, you know, Brad's under a lot of pressure at the moment. name's Kerry Billsborough. I said, Kez, he's, you know, I said, but I'll ring him and see how it pans out, you know. I said, but there's no guarantee. He wanted to take his son. He wanted to have that proud moment, father-son.
Yeah.
Go to the game and sort of show his son, like, and he was, you know, Kerry was a really great bloke. And anyway, Brad had met him, fortunately, and I rang Brad. And I said, look, you know, unfortunately, you know, Kerry's, you know, terminal, and, you know, I know you're under the pump, mate. I said, I haven't promised him anything, but, you know, anyway, to cut a long story short, so I think the game was played on Wednesday. I get a call from, you know, Kerry, you know, have you heard anything from Brad? I said, look, mate, you've just got to let it sit. I said, I don't know if we're going to hear from him or not. I said, he's getting bashed up in the media because he lost the first game. He's made a half a dozen changes, you know, for the second game.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he's even got time to breathe, let alone think of you and me.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So the next day, Tuesday, calls me. Man, is there any chance that, you know, he had his young bloke, and he was obviously anxious because he hadn't had long for this world to go, you know, yeah, himself. So anyway, late Tuesday afternoon, I get a text from Brad. Can you text me Kerry's mobile number? I text him his mobile number. Brad calls this guy on the Tuesday night before the game, brings his son into the hotel, sits down with him, personally gives him two tickets, gives him a jersey, has two or three others, you know, Bezzy, who I love, Danny Badiris, and a couple of other guys sat down with him, had a glass of water with the kid, and sort of talked about the game and this and that. I was blown away. Yeah. That's the character that Fittler's got.
Always gives his time.
Do you know what I'm saying? He's just got so much character and so much knowledge, and he's one of the best New South Wales coaches we've ever had, but... You know, you talk about that. And the second thing we talked about downstairs, when you look at all the pictures, you know, it was this Alan Ferguson, who's a mate of mine, an Indigenous kid, phenomenon. Many when I was 8 years old, played for Mount Carmel. I don't even know how I got there, Hayden. My mother took me down to Mount Carmel school. I didn't go to the school. Next thing, I'm playing for their rugby league team. Next thing, we win the comp. And I was that dumb and clunky. We won the comp. Alan Ferguson, this mate of mine, Fergo, had scored about 150 tries. You know, the tactic was pass it to
Give
Fergo.
Give the ball to him.
Bang, pass it to Fergo. Bang. Anyway, we won the comp, and I said, you know, who do we play? I was like, dumb. Who do we play next week?
Yeah.
Like, mate, it's over. We've won it. I was like, oh, okay. But you know, Fergo, where him and I met up again when we went to high school at St Mary's Cathedral, and I told you about the story when I got picked in the Roosters. Very proud moment, mate. Very proud moment. Got picked in the Roosters SG ball side with another friend of mine, Peter Chidiak, and Alan Ferguson and another guy called Tony Stutton got picked for South. And the four of us were up on the balcony at school, and they were sort of presenting us to the school, and these guys were representing a letter from the sports master. I'm thinking, this is, wow, look at this. And then afterwards, when it all died down and we were walking back down the stairs, I said to Fergo, who I'd love dearly, he's like a brother to me, I said to him, mate, what about that? I said, pretty good, huh? And he said, you? I said, yeah, mate. He goes, mate, you're a disappointment. I said, what do you mean? He said, mate, you let people down every time you play. He said, you know, you're half fit, you wander around. He said, you're not even, you know, you're not connected to the game. You're letting your teammates down. And I said, are you serious? Yeah. He said, yeah, mate, I am. And I swear to you, it was like a sledgehammer. And it split me in half. And I went home and I thought, you know, I've got this bag, I've got this jacket, I've got this all this stuff. And I thought, for one of my best mates to say that to me, I worked out that he loved me so much that he wanted the best for me, right? So from that moment, I played that year and I was okay. I was actually average, to be honest. I played that year, and then a couple of years later, I had a moment where I was trying out for the Roosters under 23s, and there were 250 people trialing, mate, and it got possibles, probables, and then that game happened and it crunched down to about, you know, 70 players, and I was still in the mix, and I thought, I'm going to do this. Like, in myself, I swear to you, it took everything in me, because, like, the competition then was so full on. Like, there were so many talented players. It was like I was almost like an out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
And I was actually fit because I'd learned the lessons from Fergo. I was ready for this.
Yeah.
You know, and thankfully I got picked and graded. Yeah. And I thought I take it right back to that moment where he hit me between the eyes, mate, like nothing ever, and I'll never forget it. He's not with us anymore, Fergo. He actually, when he was 15, he was a beach sprint champion, and he was that good. Him and his two brothers, Warren and Gilbert, played always played representative football. Now, just the most talented family. Anyway, Channel 7 came in, and they had a sports show. It might have been Wild World of Sport or wherever it was.
Yeah.
And they interviewed the three of them. They called them the Flying Fergusons. And I think between the three of them, I know Cam Murray played for Mascot, but Fergo's a bit of a legend in Mascot and, you know, South SG Ball. He kicked to win the SG Ball Grand Final. They scored in the corner, kicked the goal from a sideline with an old leather football,
yeah,
and kicked the goal to win by a point. So he's quite well known, and there was a podcast that I think Niggsy Hill did with who were the best ever players in SG Ball for South, and Fergo was one of them. They brought him up, and Mario Fennick talks about him. So when he was a beach sprint champion, he had a heart murmur, and I didn't think much of it at the time, but now I reflect on it, he actually passed away with a heart attack at a young age. You know.
Well, I saw the picture when I've entered you. I've seen the picture that means so much.
You should put it on your podcast.
I will. And he's carrying a leather ball, the old leather ball that you mentioned.
They've got this thing about them, mate. Like, you know, I call it the indigenous antenna, where they all seem to know what they're doing. I mean, then that photo that you saw, that's one of my favourite sporting photos, other than the one when Freddie scored that try, got his arm in the air and charged down Darren Lockie's kick when he was playing for New South Wales. That photo with Alan Ferguson with the ball in his hand like that, and you had George Longbottom and Kevy Stewart, who was a terrific 5'8", playing for SG Ball for South at the time. And South does grate on me saying the word South, believe me, being a Roosters guy. let's be clear.
Yeah.
Let's be clear.
Because for the listeners that don't follow rugby league, there's a huge rivalry here.
Huge. Huge, mate.
And you're at the Roosters, SG Ball, and your best mate's at South. And you've just delivered some gold that, you know, like I said at the start of this show, is I like to think, how can this help someone else? If there's someone listening that needs to give a good friend some honest feedback, it's done with love. Like you actually said, he basically held me to account that I'm letting the school team down because I'm not fit enough.
Mm.
And I think that influence on you has helped you in your whole life. Alan, he's no longer with us, but there's an influence in that because you have no problem with telling people and holding people to account along the way, and you've managed a lot of people and you've developed a lot of people, a lot of successful people. Mm. That is a topic that comes up a lot when we have some chats, is how to have that tough conversation. If it's supported by a foundation of trust and a level of trust, you use the word love, that tough conversation shouldn't really be tough. It's actually an opportunity to get better.
Mm.
You look back at that now, that's a huge moment in your life.
Oh, it was crushing. Yeah. Crushing, which
at the time was crushing. Yeah, now you realise that he loved
gold.
You
know, it was like, you know, they say that, you know, it takes a lot of pressure to make a diamond out of coal.
Mm.
You know, I was a piece of coal at that time, and he crushed me down to make a diamond, mate. And
that's a good story.
It was hard to manage.
Can we have that photo? We need to get the photo. I love the way we keep going to different stories because there's nuggets of gold everywhere. But we got the first impression bit out of the real estate that you ended up very successful in. But you stopped the real estate. What happened after that?
Well, you know, I sort of, you know, the company was going in a different direction to me. I mean, it the actual company floated, and I didn't agree with it at the time. Having said that, also, I wanted a new challenge as well, and I was investing in companies that I'd liked, and it was sort of whilst I was in real estate, and it was sort of a hobby. And then that became a sort of, you know, a job, you know, and part of the real estate thing. I love meeting people like you, mate. And I drill down into certain companies and ring CEOs and brokers and talk about, you know, what their next steps were and all that sort of stuff. And if I liked it, I'd invest in it. The other side of that too is I've been offered jobs with various companies, and I've taken a couple of them on. You know, one of them is the Carver with Fiji, and went over there recently, as you know, and had a great time. And I love Fijian people, mate. I've always loved Fijian people. They're just humble, talented, you know, sweet people that are hardworking. And you know, as you said, you know, the athletes, you know, for the population, you know, and the number of athletes they churn out. You know, you were shocked when I told you there was less than a million people in Fiji. Yeah. You know what I mean? And yes. look at the athletes that come out of it, Corabetti and you know,
Iliami Kikau. I've had some experiences with some great Fijians. I love them, but. Viliami Kikau, Apikara sounds Fijian, yeah. We did an episode on here with Viliami Kikau, and
he's one of my favourite players.
He taught me a little bit of Fijian. We spent a few years together, but
oh really?
But hearing, in fact, you love this. I know we keep digressing, but he told me when he grew up, they used to put sand and grass and dirt in an empty bottle, and that became their ball to play with. That's what they play. So I love learning about people's stories and their. How they grew up and stuff. So there's a little game that I play. Drisco loves this little game I play, 4-on-2 in a small area, and I call it, I basically saw the Fijian Sevens do something similar, so I kind of stole the idea of this game. Mm. And the players love it. It brings so much energy to a group. So we call it Fiji, and anyway, I named it after Kicks. And the day after I learned of his story, I went and, instead of putting the balls out, I went and filled some plastic bottles with dirt and grass and stuff. And I said, we're going to play this game today, boys. And, and the athleticism this game develops, but the energy and the fun, it's just, you have to name it after Fijians. That's just how they are. But listening to Kikau's story, he's one of the best. And there is an episode on, I should send it. There is an episode we did with him. That you would love. But yeah, so you've gone into all these different businesses. You do a heap of charity stuff. Why?
I suppose, you know, you want to take it right back to John Ireland, sort of, you know, channeling his energy. He's always a giving guy. I mean, I'd heard stories from his daughter about the fact that, you know, he'd go around collect you know, cans of food and all this sort of stuff, and he'd have the big station wagon. And then, you know, his daughter was telling me that, you know, one night they rang him, you know, because they couldn't get a cab, and it picked them up from some club, and there's four or five girls in the back of this big van when they were teenagers. So John had got to get up at, you know, 12:30, you know, picking these girls up from this club and driving them all home. And in the midst though of all of that in the story was the fact that there were all these tins of, you know, baked beans and soup and all this sort of stuff rattling around in the back as a kid, you know, put the brake on the soup and the tins would fall over and they had to put them back in the, you know, what's that for, Dad? Oh, I collected these, you know, they're from the supermarket, there's stock they don't want, and I deliver them to, you know, people in need and all that. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, like, you know, really? Well, that's incredible. So from that, mate, that's why I do it. I just think that, you know, Drisco particularly, like, I've said to him, you know, and he's crook today, right? So, yes. And I said to him a couple of weeks ago, and I've said it to his wife, he does too much. You know, and he you know, with the Silk Tails, I got involved in them probably 4 years ago when he was trying to build that high performance facility at the site of Daceyville PCYC. Yes. And he's arm wrestling with the council, he's arm wrestling with the, you know, builders and all this sort of stuff, and the actual PCYC itself. And I was listening to him and I were training. I'm listening, he's on the phone and he's getting all these emails. And this is just aside from his work.
His actual work, yeah.
And his family.
Yes.
And all this sort of stuff. So, you know, that John Ireland channeling, you know, empathy and charity and all that sort of stuff. I'm thinking, this guy's doing great stuff. I mean, let's see if we can try and fast track it. So I made a couple of calls. I didn't do a hell of a lot. But I helped Steve cut through a lot of the red tape and, you know, BS that's out there, all the politics, and then subsequently got to a point where built this facility for these guys, and it's just been a great, you know, community, great community triumph, I think, for that area, the Fijian peoples. assimilating into that De Seville club, yes, and the area itself, and welcoming the very welcoming Fijian people. We're actually welcoming, well, I had them here.
I saw a video.
Yeah. I had them at our house.
You had the Fijian team at your house.
Yeah, I sort of thought, I said to my wife, we've been to Fiji a number of times and they're so bloody nice.
Welcoming.
I mean, why don't we just get them, be part of the group of people that welcomes to Australia by bringing them into our home and showing them that, we're like that too. Aussies are like that, Yes. So, they really appreciate it. But Drisco's just him and Petro and, Terry Glassie and, a handful of other people have done a phenomenal job with the Silk Tails. I was just over at Fiji with them not so long ago. And, Wesley Nagama's just been coaching them, he's done such a great job. That whole group of people has been phenomenal. It really has. And then that sort of segues into a lot of the other stuff he does. With the flag team, a good mate of mine, Dean Feeney's at coaching them, and Terry's part of the flag side as well, and Steve.
Yeah.
There's this moving group of incredible giving sort of human beings that are passing on their knowledge and their spirit to all these young people.
Yes.
It's invaluable, mate.
In and amongst this chat, though, I don't know if listeners feel it, but I try to just talk about you, and you've raised millions for charity, and you're just a typical leader of people that want to build other people up. I'm trying to talk about you, and then we've just talked about all these other people, how humble you are. So I have to go there then, and you have to talk about yourself. The King's, the award you got, explain that. So what is that, the...
Oh, mate, what is the Order of Australia.
Order of Australia Medal. And explain to me, I obviously know it's got to be the highest honour, but why did you get it? And what does it mean to you?
Well,
and tell us the day you knew you were getting it, or just give me some story around this.
It's an interesting one, mate. I got an email 5 weeks out, I think it's just the 10th of June was the King's birthday. So 5 weeks prior to that, I got an email and I looked at it and I thought, I suspect like a lot of people are, someone's G'ing me up, got this water in it. And it was...
it's quite an honour.
Yeah, well, it is, and I'm, very grateful, but I looked at it and I sort of thought, and the thing that really was a real smack in the face in terms of the reality of it was... what it was for service to youth, which is sort of where I'm at, as a person in terms of, man, if young people think there's no future, guess what? There's no future, because they're the next group coming through in the population. And we talked about my brother, and I lost him, a number of years ago. But I have a philosophy, mate. We all get a turn at that. So my brother lived, and I'm segueing a little bit, but he lived about 10 lives in one. He was a lawyer. He was a whole host of things, mate. He was a great athlete. Played for the Roosters.
Great boxer.
Good boxer.
I've seen photos of him.
And a good bloke, mate. Yeah. When we said goodbye to him at St Mary's Cathedral, I spoke and I looked at the crowd. The place was packed. And I don't know if you've been to St Mary's Cathedral, but it's hard to fill it up. Right. And it was just a testament to him as a human being that there were so many people actually turned up. And there were some people spilling out at the side as well. So it was a life well lived from my perspective for him. And I love him dearly. And what I do know is at one day I'll be there, and I've got to hopefully that we all meet up at some point in the end. And, we're all playing, touch footy with a glass bottle and dirt and grass in it.
Or boxing him.
Yeah,
or sparring. Or sparring.
So, with the award, I sort of thought, I looked at it and I think, well, wow, And I sort of kept it to myself and I thought, I'm going to surprise my wife, right? So I'm not going to say anything. And then, a week out, what they do is they say, well, if we give you this award, would you accept it? And then you tick the box and say you accept it and you send it back, and they go, okay, well, we're thinking about it, right?
Yes.
So, and then 4 weeks later, I get this thing to say, you know, it's approved, you're getting it, and we're sending all the list of names out to the media, and you might be contacted. So I thought, okay. Next thing you know, I got a couple of the, you know, papers ring me. I think it was the Herald and the Telly, and they wanted a quote. And I said, that's cool. You know, yeah, look, really grateful, happy, blah, blah, blah. And then Channel 9 rings me and says, we want to interview you down at the PCYC. And I said, yeah, sure. So I did that interview, and then this is 3 or 4 days beforehand. So I thought to myself, oh, I got a bit nervous. I thought, I better tell the kids, because my daughter's at, you know, in Victoria at school at the moment. And my son is here, and I thought to myself, well, I better tell them, right?
Tell them before they see it on the TV.
See it on TV and think, oh, what's that? What's going on here, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I rang my daughter. I said, listen, this is what's happening. I said, oh, wow. And my father-in-law is quite, he's an incredibly successful person in business.
Yeah.
And my daughter said, oh, you've got one up on Pop for a change. Finally, my moment in the sun, right?
Yes,
so,
yes.
And I said to my son, who was a bit ambivalent about it all, I said, oh, mate, you got this? And he said, oh, yeah, good on you, Dad. I was like, yeah, what's for dinner? I was like, okay. So I'm sitting on this now.
So wife still doesn't know.
So I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to play it cool. You know, so Monday comes to King's birthday. You know, what I didn't know was that Channel 9 have an affiliation with, I think, Sky News. And then this came on early morning. The actual interview came on early morning at Sky News. And then my phone started going ballistic. Bing, 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 congratulations. Oh, mate, you know, let's meet, you know, at 7 o'clock for a workout, and we'll have a cup of coffee and celebrate. We've got half a dozen mates. So I went down there at 7 o'clock, and I'm thinking, my wife doesn't know anything yet.
Still doesn't know.
I go down there, have a workout. I come home, and I'm sort of, you know, how are you? No, nothing. Looking at me, yeah, good. How was it? Yeah, good. So I sit down, I have a cup of coffee, and I'm sort of watching TV, watching the news and stuff. And I'm thinking, God, the penny's got to drop. So it's now 9 o'clock. Nothing's happening. And anyway, finally, ping. She looks at the phone. She goes, oh, takes a deep breath. I thought, this is the moment, right?
Yes.
Oh my God. She goes, Order of Australia, King's birthday. I'm looking at her, yeah. She goes, Dad got the Order of Australia. Her father.
Got one on the same day.
On the same day. I'm thinking, and she doesn't know I've got one yet. And I'm sitting there going, is this real?
So she's like, so much for having something up on Pop.
It didn't work out. It's never worked out, to be frank. But and he's a great guy, and my mother-in-law's brilliant, and the whole family's fantastic. I'm just really grateful there as well. But and he's a phenomenal human being, this bloke. But
so when they give the awards, yours was for service to youth. What was his for?
His was for, you know, business achievement and philanthropy.
Right.
He's given a lot quietly to a lot of various charities. Not a lot of people would know about. You know, again, well-deserved, but, you know, the timing could have been a year later.
Yes, like, let you have the moment.
Give me a chance. I'm still sitting here on the couch, right?
She still doesn't
still
know.
Still doesn't know. She's going, And I'm thinking, well, you know, this is impressive that Dad got this. I said, yeah, no, it's a prestigious award, you know.
Yeah.
I said, it's very important. She goes, oh, you know, not many Australians get this. I said, yeah, I know. I said, it's great that he's been recognised. And anyway, to cut a long story short, it gets worse. So her phone rings and a friend rings up and she goes, oh, just wanted to congratulate you and James. James got the Order of Australia. She must have seen the news.
Yes.
And my wife sort of turns around and goes, oh, no, James didn't get it. Dad did.
Dad got
I'm thinking,
it. I did.
And then she looked at me, and then the news came on finally, and she's like, did you get it as well? I said, yeah, I did. It's weird, isn't it? Like, it's weird that your father got one, I got one. And it didn't seem as impressive when I got it.
So did you have a family celebration, and the father-in-law?
Well, we haven't yet, but they were actually overseas at the time.
Right.
And what happens now, and it hasn't happened yet, is they call it an investiture ceremony where you actually get your medal and all that sort of stuff up at Parliament House. So
right.
We're all going up and sort of, you
well,
know,
that'll be a good
family day. It's just so weird and wonderful, mate, which is sort of my life, really.
Yeah. Well, when we talk about father-in-law, I always I always refer on this show as talk to anyone old. That's been a message that was delivered to me a long time ago by a great coach, Kevin Sheedy, actually, an AFL coach.
Oh, wow. I met him.
Yeah, I was privileged one night. Yeah, well, at this time he was down in Essendon, and I flew down with Brian Smith at the time who I was working with. Right. And I always have this thing, you do some of your best learnings, like me and you now, over a coffee.
Yeah,
100%. Or over a meal or a beer or whatever. Yeah. So we went out to dinner with Kevin Sheedy. And out of all the stuff we discussed, there's a lot of things, a lot of wisdom he shared. But one of the things he said, talk to anyone old. Because if they died tomorrow, the information dies with them.
Yeah.
So unless they've written a book, this was what he said back then.
Mm-hmm.
Where now it's like there's so many ways, podcasts, content, there's so many ways other than a book now where you can share some wisdom. But he always said, talk to anyone old. And I realised I actually already did that. It was instilled in me from my father, who was a coach. And I was actually doing it at the time. I was talking to Kevin, who was older. But for 20-odd years, I've gone around, even around the world, to learning off different people, a lot of older people in the coaching space. And for you, is there that, I mean, there's obviously father-in-law, I'm sure you've drawn on for advice before and mentoring. Is there any, if I asked you of older people that, we mentioned John earlier, but is there people in your life that have taught you something that you could share now that's helping someone else? Is there any other people? We've mentioned some keys. We've mentioned your best mate when you were 17. We've mentioned John, the CEO of a hospital. We've mentioned, I'm sure, is there any lessons from your father-in-law? Or is there people in your life that have influenced you that we could finish the episode with and some little nuggets of gold that will help someone else?
Well, you know, you talk about your wife and you clear your light up and, you know, you get that support. My wife, she's got an MBA. She speaks French. She speaks Japanese. She's incredibly intelligent. She's a wonderful mother and like a really great partner. Like we get on really well. She's we laugh a lot and all that sort of stuff. I think that's important in your life. We've been married, you know, almost 25 years and it's been a great journey, and it sort of gets, you know, in my mind at least, probably have to speak to her, and it's getting better, right? But you know, she might have a different view. to answer your question, there's a bloke called Dennis Cleary. When I was a kid, that boxing room was a real sort of, a lot of darkness and a lot of light. You know, there was a lot of moments that were quite tragic and a lot of moments that were quite brilliant all in the same day, you know, in some instances. And just as a kid, some of the people that have come through it, there are all sorts of weird and wonderful stories that come out of it. But Dennis Cleary, when I was a kid, you know, I'd be sort of pretending to train and just look around at everybody and seeing the dynamic. And it was on some days, it was quite frightening to see that now you had guys like, Tony Mundine, you know, Anthony's father training there, to see these Tony Mundine was like a god.
Yes.
You know, and I'm like a kid on a skipping rope watching this guy. You've ever seen an athlete and a beautiful mover, like in terms of boxing and just an athlete in general, and you know, you look at a bloke like Tony Mundine in that moment, and I'm there physically. There's no video of it. But the video's inside my head.
Yes.
And I can replay it any time I want. They're obviously called memories. And I'm big on memories. You know, you talk about Danny Green. I did the Sydney to Hobart. There's a funny story there. I don't know if we've got time.
We have time.
I'll get back to that with Greeny. But, Dennis Cleary was, and Bruce Collins for that matter, whom I'm still good friends with even when I was a kid. They're a lot older.
Yes.
They were the type of people, you know, so Bruce Collins got the Order of Australia, fought in Vietnam, did some stuff that, you know, people wouldn't want to do, but are very grateful that he did.
Yes.
Right, back in those days. That's one person. And the other bloke, Dennis Cleary, his brother was Michael Cleary. Michael Cleary played on the wing for Souths in all those you know,
a sprinter as well.
Correct.
Went to the Commonwealth Games, I think.
I think he went to the Olympics as maybe. Well. I think the Olympics as well.
Yeah, one. We need him on the show. Yeah, one so, of the greats.
I saw Michael out at the footy stadium not that long ago.
Yeah.
And the so the last game that the Roosters played at the footy stadium against South, we won. And the first game ever played at the new Allianz Stadium, we won.
There you go. Bang. There you go. You and had I to go back Michael, to the rivalry.
I saw Michael Cleary out there, but Dennis is he's had a few. He's had a few health issues, and you know, we picked him up and had a cup of coffee with him. But when I was a kid, I'd see blokes like him and Tony Mundine and all this stuff. And Dennis had a job, you know, he worked for Macquarie Bank, and he was the sort of guy you wanted to be. He was incredibly well spoken. He was intelligent. He was, you know, numbers smart and book smart, and dressed incredibly, impeccably, like, yeah. You know. And he's the sort of guy, when he had this booming voice, he goes, oh, you know, almost like Ray Warren, you know. Yeah. I've got an appointment with the Prime Minister on Tuesday. I've got lunch. Ducky, what are you doing? I'm riding my bike home. What are you? You know, so this guy is like the golden god, yes. Dennis Cleary. And yeah. you sort of look at him and you think, well, smart, hardworking, well-dressed, incredibly well-spoken, and comes into this gym, yeah. Let's say, where this eclectic group of people, you know, you got the, and I'm still good friends with most of them, you know, the guy who works on the back of the garbage truck and the guy here that works on the quarry bank and everything in between.
Yeah.
Everything in between. And some of the athletes and some of the lessons you learn, and some of them was quite brutal. I mean, some of the people that had, and they get moved out pretty quickly.
Mm.
You know, if you're not, if you haven't got empathy for the opponent who's less skilled than you, then
yeah.
you know, you've moved on very quickly. And had some situations there were quite unpalatable, which, and as I say, it's like sorting the wheat out from the chaff. It gets sorted out very quickly. Those people yeah. aren't invited back. So, but in the moment when you see it and it happens, and then it's just quite like, you know, right. Is this happening? You know. In front of your eyes.
So he had a big influence on you.
A huge influence, mate. I mean, everyone wanted to be like Dennis. Everyone, you know, so the big job, the come in and good, you know, good athlete, strong, big voice.
Would he be someone during your career in business that you'd reach out to for a bit of mentoring?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like I'm so massive personally, which I now try to share through this podcast, he's learning off, just by talking, learning off so many leaders around the world in different industries. Did you deliberately go and do that? Did you pick up the phone and just bounce stuff over?
When I got the job, you know, I applied for the job. I remember back in the day, as the payroll manager for St. Vincent's, and you know, I was numb in the interview, numb from the point of view I was scared to death. And I was sort of scared to death that I might get the job. Right. Because I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do it. But I must have put on a reasonable show, because there were a half dozen people went for it. I got the job and I thought, oh, what am I going to do? So what I did, I worked out from the time that I'd met, you know, these other people that worked in other payroll offices who managed the bigger, you know, staff numbers in other hospitals that were the payroll. I'd ring them. Yeah. And then I'd ring the people that ran the payroll services, and I'd get all the answers from them. So what I was doing, it was, I didn't know how to do something, so I went to someone who knew how to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So bloke yeah. like you, if someone doesn't know how to do something like, you know, the fast twitch yeah. hip flex, how to move your feet in the ruck, they go to you,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So I don't know how to do it. So I worked that out, that any time I never knew how to do something, I went to someone that I knew how to do it and do it well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I identified that and then went to them and hopefully they will share that information, which thankfully I have been very lucky with people that have been sharing that information with me. And I became pretty good at it, you know, because I was actually using other people as the conduit to my success.
Yes.
But they were grateful enough. They were gracious enough to be able to give me the information I needed.
And because I've seen now you do a lot of now helping other people that reach out to you for mentoring. I've noticed a bit of that.
I think it's born out of what you learnt and how you were, you know, not all the time, but you know, how you were treated by really good people. Do Do you know what I mean? So, you know, I see you. I've seen you in the gym. I've seen what you do to people. You want to genuinely. I've seen you do it. I've heard about you. You know, you want to bring people up, and you do. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's something that's inside. It's inside you. It's in your DNA. You have to have it in your DNA. You have to learn it from other people, and then subsequently reproduce it. But that's the essence of life, mate, because, you know, as I said to you before, my philosophy is you're here for a certain period of time from A to Z, and all the alphabet in between. You've got to actually have experiences for yourself. You've got to, you know, give to others and end up, you know, that's how the success plays out, you know. Yes. All the things you do between A and Z. And there's no dodging the fact that we all get an ending.
Yes.
You know, there's no dodging it. I think the realization, I had that realization, I think I mentioned to you, when I was 12 years old. And it came to me in a really brutal way, where I was chosen at junior school to sit for a scholarship, which would have paid for my secondary education. And mate, I got electrocuted, almost got killed.
Nearly died.
And then I spent, you know, months in hospital, and I couldn't do the things I used to be able to do. You know, I'd pick up a book and I'd read it like in half the time anybody else could.
Yes.
And I was just a sponge for information, just bang, 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 bang. But I couldn't do that anymore. So it became a more, and the fact of the matter, mate, when I went over, my mother took me out of hospital. I had holes in my fingers from the burn from the, and the only reason I was let off the hook, so to speak, from the charge of the electricity was I had rubber-soled shoes on. Now, the first thing the doctor did was took my shoes off and looked at the bottom of my feet, even though I had holes in my fingers, because what happens is the charge goes through you, comes out your feet. But since I had rubber-soled shoes on, it stopped that, because it's not a conductor.
Yeah.
So he said to me, "You were a very lucky boy. You're a very lucky boy you had those sand shoes on because you wouldn't be here, mate." You know, and I thought, I took that information and I thought to myself, I'd lay in bed in the hospital for months, and I'd listen to listen to the radio. It was quite good, actually. It was some of the tunes on the, I'd sort of learned the songs. It was quite relaxing, to be honest with you. And I replayed in my mind what the doctor said, and then I formed the view that I was, how lucky I was, and I was just relaxing in the bed. I was recovering, and you know, the radio on, and my mother had come and visit me, and you know, la 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 la. And then I just got myself back into the groove of life again. But it was a very different person, mate. I was a different person.
Wow.
I was more spiritual than hard-hitting sort of, you know, intellect, you know, because
experience that at 12.
Oh, mate, it was...
To realise...
It was heavy.
Mm.
It was heavy, but, you know, somehow, mate, I bounced out of it.
Right, we could talk for hours, but we have to go there because Danny Green's a mutual contact.
Greeny.
Greeny's done an episode on here before. I'd spent many great years with him, and he shared some great wisdom, even from his own father, who worked for your father-in-law.
Oh, no,
Snowy,
Malcolm.
You would have met Malcolm.
I met Malcolm, yeah.
Yeah, he was a great man, and Greeny shared some stuff around, even just as simple as just surround yourself with good people. That's probably the message Malcolm gave Danny. And I'd like to think I may have been a good person around Greeny for a period of his career.
How long were you with him, mate?
Yeah, for about 6 years.
I'll tell you now, Greeny's a bit like a lot of people I know. You know, if you're not who you say you are, and you know, he'd look at you for a couple of days or a week and he'd be cut.
Yeah,
you know, six years with him is like...
Well, we had some great times. And he won some world titles in there, but he did the Sydney to Hobart, and he talks about it with fond memories. And we've been chatting and found out you did it with him.
Well, mate, I was the reason he did it.
Were you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I met him at a lunch a little while previously, and we became sort of mates from that.
Yeah.
And I loved him. He's so full of, you know, life, you know, as a person.
Yeah.
And a mate of mine bought a boat out of New Zealand called Maximus. And the funny thing about the boat that came out of New Zealand, and the guy that bought the boat out said, "Mate, you're the first one picked." And we spoke. And in my head, like, I always have these moments, Hayden. I don't know if you have, mate, but I see something that I want to do and I store it in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
And I know at some point it's going to be there and the opportunity will present itself. And then it's a matter of whether you're ready to take it or not. So I'm thinking I saw the city in Hobart probably 10 or 15 years prior to the time I did it. And I thought to myself, I really want to do that. That looks really challenging. It looks amazing. You know, one of the most, you know, dangerous sea journeys you can do. And I'm thinking in my head, I'm thinking, oh yeah, I'd love to do that anyway. So this mate of mine buys this boat out of New Zealand called Maximus. And you know, I think it started the race a couple of times and didn't finish it. Like it broke down.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'm thinking, oh my God. So rebadged the boat, made it. I thought, is this thing going to make it from New Zealand to Sydney? You know? So he bought the boat out and then he said, look, what we need to do is get some people, you know, that high profile types to you know, raise some money for charity. I said, yeah. And he said, you know, who do you know? And I said, oh, you know, I know a couple of people, you know, Danny Green. He goes, oh, Danny Green. I said, yeah. He goes, you know him? I said, yeah, I know him. Anyway, Greeny happened to be fighting for a title at the same time against Roy Jones.
Yes.
Right? So I'm talking to Greeny and he's, and I said, listen, you are going to do the Sydney to Hobart with me. He said, you are joking. He said, mate, I'm scared of sharks. He said, I know I surf and all that sort of stuff. He said, but there's no way in the world I'm going to do the Sydney Hobart. I said, mate, you're going to do it with me. I said, I hate it as much as you do. I said, that means that we'll both do it and we'll have an interesting experience. And he goes, mate, there's no way in the world. So I rang him the next day and I said, mate, listen, we're going to do the Sydney Hobart, right? He goes, listen, Dackie, I've got a bit on. A bit on was bit actually on. Fighting for a
world title.
You ought to bit on. I said, oh, look, I know you've got a bit on. I said, but this is after the event. I said, you'll do what you've got to do. And then after that is when the training starts and all the rest of it. And he goes, okay. He goes, look, you know, because I kept bugging him. He goes, look, give me the weekend to think about it and call me Monday, right?
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, I'm not going to call him Monday. In my head, I'm not calling him Monday. He's expecting me to call him Monday. And he goes, I call him Wednesday. And he goes, oh, I can't believe you called me Wednesday, mate. He said, in between Monday and now, I've changed my mind 100 times. And he said, now that you've called, I've landed on yes.
I'm good.
He said, if you called me Monday, I would have said no. He said, you're a prick. I, you know, that's okay to say on this. He said, you're a prick. And I said, mate, I sort of thought that if I called you Monday, you were pretty hot on the no.
Yes.
I said, but mate, if you might have cooled off and thought about it. So to cut a long story short, mate, he agreed to do it. It was a great trip. Loved doing it with him. He's courageous.
What was the charity for?
Oh, it was a whole host of charities, mate.
Okay.
So each individual person that raised money, the whole amount of money raised was split between the crew, and then they gave it to it. Mine was the Matthew Talbot Hostel in Woolloomooloo. I don't know. I'm not sure what Greeny's was. You can ask him.
Yes,
I'll call him after this.
Yeah, he talks about it as a great experience in his life.
Courageous bloke, mate.
And,
you know.
Well, you're a good judge of character. If you had to describe Danny Green, forget about his boxing even, just that experience you had with him, because I know what I think of him. Describe Danny Green.
Loyal. Fearless. He's a deep spiritual sort of a bloke. He's a thinker. So he is very careful about what he does. But when he makes a decision to do it, you know, he's the sort of bloke that won't let you down.
100%. How would you like people to describe you?
Well, you know, it's funny, mate. I've actually thought of this, and I thought about what my mother used to say to me, you know. And it's a term that I don't think people really think about, but you're going to say he was a gentleman, right? That's how I'd like to be described. Like, he was a gentleman. You know, I haven't always been like that, mate.
Yes.
Like, you know, but having said that, that's how I'd like to be remembered. You know, they say that, you know, sometimes if you get a group of people in the room, the most aggressive person and the loudest person and the person that tries to intimidate people the most is the person that's the most scared.
Yes.
And if you look at that, and the 9 times out of 10 from, you know, from my brother particularly, he was always really calm, you know, no matter what was going on. And I think that that shows a degree of intelligence if you can remain calm in an environment. When someone flares up, if something goes wrong, then you can see from my perspective that there might be a bit of a character issue, but if everyone's just calm, understands what they need to do and what to do or what the next part of the process is, then that to me is a gentleman.
100%. How would you like people to describe you?
Well, it's funny, mate. I've actually thought of this, and I thought about what my mother used to say to me, and it's a term that I don't think people really think about, but to say he was a gentleman, right? That's how I'd like to be described. Like, he was a gentleman. I haven't always been like that, mate.
Yes.
But having said that, that's how I'd like to be remembered. They say that, sometimes if you get a group of people in the room, the most aggressive person and the loudest person and the person that tries to intimidate people the most is the person that's the most scared.
Yes.
And if you look at that, and the 9 times out of 10 from my brother particularly, it was always really calm, no matter what was going on. And I think that shows a degree of intelligence if you can remain calm in an environment. When someone flares up, if something goes wrong, then you can see from my perspective that there might be a bit of a character issue, but if everyone's just calm, understands what they need to do and what to do or what the next part of the process is, then that to me is a gentleman.
You are a gentleman, Dakin. Thanks so much for
my pleasure, mate.
That's so good.